Okay, well, this is not going to be a message. It's not even going to be a lecture. We're going to interact together on some ideas. We have our notes in the notebook here. I think it's on P10 or P11, something like that, where we start in. I've put this in here just so that you don't have to feverishly take notes on things. We can just kind of stay ahead of things and use our time interacting. Back to the context. Last night, Donald spoke about the cultural milieu in which we live, and he ended up with three observations that characterize our society. One is that the moral vision that our society is to be built upon has really melted down. And as a result of that, there is no cohesive set of values that hold this society together. We may say things are good now, but we're really spending the capital, the spiritual capital, the moral capital of past generations. And then he made a comment that we have lost our respect for truth, and truth is whatever you really want it to be. And if it's expedient to, if it's good for business, if it's good for your relationships to operate on truth, then so be it. If it isn't, well, that's okay too. And then he made the third observation, that is that talked about the instrumental view of people. Sometimes you might feel that way, that you're just kind of an instrument in your business and so on. As long as you produce, as long as you perform, you're in there. But if you falter or if you become obsolete, you're out of there and nobody's ever going to think about you again. And so people are means rather than an end. And that's a very impersonal way to live. Paul Stanley talked about the various seasons in our lives. I heard people afterwards saying, yeah, I resonate with that. That's kind of the way my life has been. The interesting thing about it, and this is a helpful way to approach things because it gives us an understanding of our personal context. And as we listen, as we work on things here in these next couple of hours, you should be listening with the ears of a person that's in whatever age bracket that you are, you find yourself in, because there are certain questions that are relevant to you at your point in life that won't be relevant to another person. And so that's helpful. The other thing that we learned from Paul is that at any point you can make a bad turn that will compromise, you know, what comes of your life in the future. And so it's scary. I mean, you get one trip through life, take a few bad turns, and you're in trouble. I mean, deep trouble. Afterwards, I was talking to Chris, and he asked, what about the people in your life, the people that you're ministering to? Of course, you minister to peers, and so I'm ministering to guys about my age. Do they have, how did you put that, Chris? Do they have a problem with meaning, or was that the question? They have a crisis with meaning, and what I observe about the people that we're reaching out to is that they will not let you see them sweat. I mean, they may really be struggling. And it's very, very hard for them to admit it. I mean, they could be hemorrhaging, and they will not admit that they're even bleeding. And what gives them away is what they do with their time. You know, one guy is totally absorbed in taking 2 points off his golf score. And, you know, that would be nirvana if he could just get 2 points off his golf score. Another guy, he has season's tickets to every major, the Broncos and the Avalanche, the Nuggets. And then they open up a new arena here and has tickets, season tickets for all of those. And so what they're doing is they're looking for things to occupy their lives. But when it comes down to meaning, I mean, there's a real desperation. And so they are dealing with fragmentation. Now, what's going on? In your notes here, I've got a paragraph that what I want to do in this session is compare our contemporary modern society with the society in which Christianity first was birthed. And what happened back there was that they used the existing structure of that society for the advantage of the gospel. I'm not suggesting at all that we should go back to the good old days, 20 centuries back, and try to reconstruct a society that's long gone. That's folly. But they did some things back there that we can look at and really gain some lessons from. and it'll help us put perspective on what's going on in our own lives. And that's what I want to do in these next few minutes. We're going to be interacting around the tables. And so if you're sitting with people that you don't want to talk to, go find another table. It looks like most of the tables are pretty well. There's just four people here. We might want to do something about that. We're going to get into this material, and then we'll have you interacting around the table, and I want to get some feedback, and we're going to work our way through these ideas. So, Bible times. I'm reading that off the page. The basic social unit of the first century Greco-Roman society was the household, or oikos. The Greek Empire had been fragmented, and in the Greek Empire, when it was in its heyday, the palace was the centerpiece around which the whole society was constructed. And when it began to fall apart, when the Dorians came in, this was fragmented, and palace no longer was the center of things. So they formed independent associations or guilds to make the society work. And often, the center of this guild was a household. And so the household was both a social and an economic unit. It was an integrated system that included family, the education of the kids in the family, leisure, religion, production, trading, consumption. The household was headed by a ruler, oikisti, who oversaw the family, defended the traditions, and conducted the business of production and trading. And so here you have the diagram, and you have the same thing in your notebook. The Hebrew social structure was very similar. One distinction was that the Hebrew society, they didn't normally have slaves within the household. Interesting illustration of the oikos we have in Genesis chapter 14. Now we're back 16 centuries before Christ. And here's what happened. When Abraham heard that his relative had been taken captive, he called out the 318 trained men born in his household and went in pursuit as far as Dan. During the night, Abram divided his men to attack them, and he routed them, pursuing them as far as Hobah, north of Damascus. He recovered all the goods and brought back his relative Lot and his possessions, together with the women and the other people. And so here you have one household, and among other things that went on in the household, they had an army, and they were all soldiers born within Abraham's household. So that was kind of a substantial, imagine the dinner table around that household. So you get this notion of Abraham's household going off to recover Lot's household. And so it was the social structure of that day. Glen Eyrie here is a good illustration of a household. When General Palmer started building in, 1890-something, he envisioned a self-contained socio-economic unit. You have, some of you are probably staying in the servants' quarters here in the castle. Down in the carriage house, there are servants' quarters. And then you have the gatehouse, and people stayed there. And you have the greenhouse where they had the greenhouses there for raising things. And so they raised their own food. They raised their own cattle, they raised their own horses, and so it was a socioeconomic unit. So that's an illustration of what we're talking about here. Production went on, you had the servants and everything else. And so that's the basic idea. Now, the first century church, especially the churches among the Gentiles, they just used this model. And so what would happen would be the gospel, when it would be received often, and you'll see this in these passages, often it would be the family head that would take on the gospel. Interesting. We need to think about that. We go for the marginal people in a family often when we think about evangelizing. You'd see that the head of the household would respond, and then the message would flow within the household. And it would also flow from household to household. And so this household served as the basic form of the local church. And the average household at that time, the average church, would be about 30 people. And because there were no church buildings for the first 300 years. And so what would happen would be that when the head of the household would receive the gospel, he would turn around and he would pass that on to his family, and the family would be predisposed to respond to it. For better or for worse, the religion of a household would be often determined by the person that was leading it. An example is in Joshua 24:15, where Joshua is talking to the people of Israel, and they'd been going through, you know the story. By the time Joshua was there, they had spent 40 years in the wilderness. They had conquered the land. Joshua is about to die, so you've got a lot of time passing. And then in Joshua 24:14, he says, "Now fear the Lord and serve Him with all faithfulness." He says, "Throw away the gods your forefathers worshipped beyond the river and in Egypt." Can you imagine that? All this time, Israel, traveling around in the desert and everything else, they never let loose of their idols. And he says, "And serve the Lord. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve, whether the gods of your forefathers served beyond the rivers or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we will serve the Lord." And so there was an integrity. In a household, the way a person responded, the way the head of the household responded, determined the way everything went. And so what you have here is the family head was key to what went on in the family. And whatever religion there was, and if it was Christ, well, then that would have its effect upon the way you'd relate to your servants and the way the servants would relate to you, what you taught your children, what kind of a social life you had, how it affected your the way you did your business, how you'd produce things. And so what you have is an integration of all of the pieces of life around what you believed. Now, that was a tremendous advantage. And we'll see in a few minutes how this integration between the parts characterizes life today. And so there's an idea in here that I think can transform the way we live. Now, what I'd like you to do is read these next passages, starting with Acts 11. And in this first section, up from Acts 11 through Philippians 4, we'll see how the household served to spread the gospel. Okay? Then we will see in these next passages, Romans 16 on, that the household had a very specific function in the life of the church. So it'll take you about 3 minutes to read this out loud. I'd prefer that you read it to yourself. But read just this first section here, Acts 11 through Philippians 4:22. Read it to yourself and then make eye contact with the other people at your table. And when you're ready to talk about it, just discuss it. Appoint a leader at your table and discuss it. And this whole thing will take about maybe 7-8 minutes. Okay? So you're on your own. Okay, finish the sentence you're on, and then stop and read the next section of, I think we've got a half a dozen other texts. Just stop and read those and then go back to discussing when you've finished reading it. The question this time, this next section, is what is the place of the household in the life of the church? See, the first question was, how did the use of the household help in the spreading of the gospel? Now we're talking about what did it do for the life of the church, okay? So carry on. Either read or continue to talk, but we'll work our way through this second section as well. What is the place of the household in the life of the church? That's the question we're working on now. All right. I'd like a couple of volunteers to rove with these microphones. They're both alive. Come on, John, you can help with one, and Terry, another one. What'd you see? What did you see? What advantages did this arrangement offer that over against what we see today, or anything else that you saw? Okay, go ahead, Brett.
My table just asked me to give them some of my thoughts, and I have a 5-point sermon here.
All right, fine.
No, but anyway, the one in particular that he had, I made the point that in a war, the Air Force does not win wars. The army doesn't win wars. Countries don't win wars. It's the individual units that win the wars. And what we observed is if you look at that second set of passages and you identified functions, the first one talks about that unit being a center of worship, a worship unit. They're also a service unit. It was a comfort unit and a communications unit. Hmm. And so it wasn't that Paul didn't see the church as a large church. He was ministering to the church at Philippi. That was many home units. That was many household units. But the messages were disseminated to units, and each unit was fighting the battles, street to street, house to house. And that's how the war was being won. The war wasn't being won by the church. It was being won because each unit was taking its part. And when one of the units fell, Paul says, you know, go help that household because that unit is falling. And so maybe there is an analogy, and maybe we tend to think of, we see a household, we think of our little family. I mean, my three children, that's my household unit. Well, that's not my household unit. Maybe our household unit is that small group at the church that meets, or maybe it's this fellowship. But however, that becomes our unit, and that's our unit for doing battle and winning wars. Just a thought.
Very good. Very good. Someone else?
I thought it was interesting in talking to John and asking him, John Ridgway, the different relationships in the household of the Indian or the Hindu and Muslims, where you deal with a household. It's kind of interesting as a concept of rather working in one person who might be ostracized as a result of coming to the Lord, working through the entire family so that that person is not ostracized. And we look at it in terms of one and one, and often people come to know the Lord and they are ostracized from their family rather than working through the entire family, which is kind of an interesting concept.
Yes, that's a very valuable concept. Someone else?
Since I can't give this up, I'll say something.
Yes.
our group was observing the role of women in the early church. Many of these were the churches that met at some woman's house, and they obviously had a key role. And then we began talking about the degree of care and good listening and things like that that probably took place because of the way this church manifests itself in the household. And then someone said, well, you know, in our culture, we tend to think about going to church. In that culture, they were the church.
By the way, notice on these, in the second section, Romans 16:5-6, 1 Corinthians 16:19, Philippians 1:1-2. It talks about the church that meets in their house. The word meets is not in the original. When we think of church, we think of meetings. No, it's just life together. And so the translators have such a are frozen into this particular paradigm of what a church does. We know, we sit and we look at the back of each other's heads and we do certain things, and that's church, that they put it in here in the translation. It doesn't belong in the original. Okay? Good comment. Anybody else here? Okay, let me rephrase the question. Let's suppose that you're back there and the church meets in your house and they're looking to you for leadership. What would that do to you? Yeah. What would that do to you? Here we go. Here's.
Well, they're looking.
Is this on?
Yes.
They're looking for a role model. And as you meet the circumstances in your own life, they're looking to see how you react to those circumstances, mm-hmm. whether Christ is really alive in your life. And and then they're looking for the love in your life that you have for other people, I think, and how that's fleshed out in the love that you show. And then the encouragement that you give to them in their daily walk.
Yeah.
And so it's really role modeling and reaching out to other people when you'd rather just curl up in your own little cocoon sometime.
Yeah. Okay, that's a one over here, one over there. Yes.
Just when I was in Ghana, food was very, very scarce. And some of our missionaries would ship in food and would use it in their neighborhood and make it available to the people that were there. And that was, I just thought of, Badu in Indonesia, and, you know, here sits Wati, and she can't go out and fight the crowds. And I wonder if anyone will decide that the way they're going to testify for Christ is to share what they have in the neighborhood.
Hmm. Okay, one more, and then we're going to move on. There's Keith over here.
I guess when you move the church to the home, a sense of responsibility takes place, and that's a scary thing.
Hmm.
And therefore, a leader has to rise and must lead, and therefore it becomes more visible, and the role model becomes more visible. Without that sense of responsibility, it's passed on to the church.
Yeah. I think that's the big word for, you want to say one more thing, Brent?
Well, yeah. The other thing is that suddenly you have a responsibility for the next generation.
How's that?
Well, as the passing on of the torch, is the number one role of the elder in even today.
Yes.
When I lived in Turkey, the elder would literally sit in the center of the town, and the children would come to the elder. And the number one role, that of passing the legacy on, skipping generations, and that suddenly would become the role of that head. And it just occurs to me that that's not something we normally associate with the head of the church, skipping that generation.
Yes. Okay, let's move on. We've got to watch the time here. I heard you say several things. One big word that came out was the importance of relationships. The fact that if you're just a nucleus of people that know you very well and know you in your BC days, and now here you are, you say you're following Christ, there is a responsibility, there's an accountability, there's a healthy pressure to be congruent in every area of life, the way you run your business, the way you relate to your kids, and everything else. Another thing that I think is significant is the simplicity of it. They didn't create new forms. They just used the ones that were there. And so it had high mobility within a society because you didn't have to go someplace else to do something strange. It was all right there in your home. And another advantage was just that it kept the networks of relationships intact. And the gospel followed the lines of relationships. And so the roads were already built. And they didn't tear them down in the process of seeing the gospel grow. Now, so often what happens is a person comes to Christ, he's yanked out of his whole network that he spent 30 years building, and he goes and he begins to relate to people he never laid eyes on before in his life. And the great opportunity of the accumulation of his whole lifetime has been lost. I think it held together on the basis of relationships. Gave you plenty of practice to hammering out the kinds of relationships that you need to have if you're going to be a follower of Christ. And then, of course, just the size. If it's just, you know, a group of 30 people or so, if that's the average size, well, then you can't hide. I mean, you're there. You're vulnerable. Well, now let's go on and let's compare what we saw with where we are. This is where we are in our contemporary society, and you got this in your notes as well. This is the way our society is today. The predominant structure of our society is the institution. Now, I'm using institution. It's a neutral word. I'm not, you know, it's neither bad nor good. There are good institutions and there are bad institutions. But an institution is an organization that has formalized its procedures into policies. It functions according to systems or procedures, and so it's a formalized organization that operates on a defined protocol that it has chosen. Now, here's the way our society works. Family, we've been busy redefining the family in the last few years. You know, we can hardly talk about the nuclear family any longer, mom, pop, and two, three kids. Whatever we want to say the family is, whatever's left of it, well, there it is. Well, you know, I go off to work, and my business is out there someplace, and that is institutionalized. You have your banking institutions, you have your commercial institutions, and so, you know, the industrial institutions, and so your work is institutionalized. You don't have very many mom-and-pop operations of any kind today. Because if you do it and it works, you franchise it and you turn it into an institution. And so it becomes a very impersonal thing. And so then, you know, you send your kids off to school, you know, just as business is an institution, school is certainly an institution. And we're in the process right now of the state taking over more and more of both the curriculum but also the instruction on the area of values. And so we send our kids off to learn things. We have no idea what it is that they're learning. Your kids need, you know, they need, Dad, you know, show me how to throw a ball. Come on, let's go out and play. And what do? Man, you're so busy, you think, man, there's this little league thing over here. And so you send them to another institution just to learn to throw a ball. I have a nephew that started playing little league baseball when he was 4 years old. And so, you know, you don't just go out and play in the sand lot any longer. You get into something that's really pretty organized and pretty structured, and that has its effect. You know, grandmother gets old and needs some help, and what do we do with her? Well, they have places for grandmothers that need help, and so we send her off to the institution. Entertainment, boy, talk about big business. This last movie, Titanic, $200 million budget. Nobody blinks an eye. I mean, the movie industry is an enormous institution. We're going to watch a bowl game on Sunday. Paul, remember to keep it short because the game starts at 10:30. We're heading for sports, organized pro sports. I mean, that's one of the most enormous institutions there is, and either in the entertainment field of any kind, it has certainly been institutionalized. Social services. You know, somebody has a problem, we say, man, let's just find the appropriate, the appropriate organ to take care of that person. I know one family that calls 911 and the social services to solve their domestic conflicts. And so the police will pull up and they're busy helping the family. The institution helps the family work their way through a particular problem. The mall is a new institution where it's not just a place where we've institutionalized marketing. We've turned that into an art form. But it also, of course, the mall has become the synagogue of this generation. And so then religion, we say, well, you know, we've got the church. But what happens when you go to church? You hit the front door, and according to your age, size, and weight, you head in a different direction. And so, oh yeah, you have some addiction problems. Yeah, that's four doors down and to the left. Oh, you're a single mother. Yeah, well, that's over here, going on three doors. And so we have institutionalized virtually everything. And so when you get in that room, what do you meet? What do you find? A what?
More of you.
More of me. Yeah, people just like me. Yes. And what are we doing? We're going through a program that has been designed by professionals to help people that have the addictions that I have. And so, in all of my life, I never really need even a genuine human relationship. And what I'm getting is programs. Now, what happens here is that because of this, we are an institutionalized society. Programs have replaced relationships. And we don't even realize it. How many real relationships does the average person have? True relationships. Friendships where you can sit down and bleed in front of another person and really pour it out. How often can that even happen? There's just no space for it. And so we resolve our needs by looking for an appropriate institution. And then because it's fragmented, what happens is over here, I'm one thing, and I'm expected to behave in a certain way because that's where I am now. Then I get over here, and I behave in a different way. And I have some, you know, some friends over here, social. I get over here, I behave in a different way. And so I'm playing a series of roles that don't necessarily overlap. That's called privatization. Whatever it is you believe, keep it to yourself. If you are a certain way here, then that really doesn't, the message is just keep that at home. That doesn't really belong in the marketplace. And so often I hear people say, I go to church and I feel so good and I come out and I wonder an hour later, where is it? Why can't I maintain it? Well, it's because we've compartmentalized ourselves to the point where nothing overlaps into the next thing that goes on in our lives. And, of course, if this is the way life is, we're busy covering the bases. Our cars put on a lot of miles. And, you know, if you're a mom with kids that are, you know, in lessons and this and that and the other thing, you know, you're gonna pile the miles on in your car. And so what happens is the significance of the home, what happens to that? Nothing's going on. That's empty. And so we lose the sense of meaning. We lose a sense of the whole. Now, the problem is we like it this way. We really like it this way because it's neat, it's antiseptic, efficient. And so, you know, we don't resist this because to stop and take care of things, to stop and deal with things, that's a nuisance that we just don't want to bother with. And besides, there are professionals over there, they know how to take care of this sort of thing. And so what happens to us as individuals? We've really got nothing to do. Personal responsibility is minimalized. We become observers. And I write the question, how can we be so busy and so marginalized at the same time? We are so busy. But nothing that we do is really meaningful. That's our problem. Because we're really left with nothing that is meaningful to do. So what do we do about this? Well, that's what we're going to be talking about these 2 days. But basically, it's we need to take things back that we never should have given away. We have given away our souls. And we're left with an emptiness, trying to improve our golf score by 2 strokes. playing pinochle by the hour because there's really nothing else to do. In our notes, what do? We need to take things back that we should have never given away. There are certain responsibilities that are essential to our survival. We cannot afford to delegate them to any institution. Then I list four of them, and we're going to be talking about these. What we're going to talk about then is what it is that we need to take back, why we need to take it back, and how to get it back. That's the agenda for this weekend.